Well, good morning. How's everybody doing? Good. Are you awake? Okay, if you're not awake yet, you will be by the time I'm done. So we'll have a lot of good stuff to talk about today. If you're new, my name is Kurt. I am one of the pastors here. And we are in our fifth week this morning on a series we're doing called Solomon on Sex. It's a study through the Song of Solomon. Now, I know there are a few people here who are new, so let me just take a moment to orientate you to the book. The book is a series of poetic love songs that are sung between Solomon and his first bride. The songs are poetic, they're romantic, sometimes they're a little explicit, but the reason we're studying it is because they're part of God's Word. And God said his word is all inspired for us, and it is profitable for us. And he put it in his word, and he inspired his word, because it's stuff that we need to hear. So that is why we are studying this often ignored book. Now, to tell you a little bit more about how this book is structured, it's put together in what is called a lyriad idyllic. I'm not even sure if I'm pronouncing it right. I know how it's spelled. I read it, but I don't always pronounce it. What that is, it's a connection of poetic small songs, like snapshots of their relationship together. They're not necessarily in chronological order, and we'll see one this morning that is not in chronological order. They're in rough order put together. So that's how it is assembling itself. We have seen a couple of these things so far. We started out on their wedding day. Remember that? She was trying to attract her husband with some really expensive smelling perfume and doing a good job of it. And then last week, we went into the bridal chamber when she saw it for the first time, and she discovered it was her favorite color, which is green. That's right. She was excited about green. This morning, we are in chapter 2, verse 8. And actually, this is one of the ones that is not in order. It is a flashback. It's a flashback. She describes what it was like when her and Solomon were dating. So if you are one of the single and searching people, this is a great message for you this morning because it's a dating message. And the married people, they probably haven't finished all their homework from the last 2 weeks anyway. So you have an extra week to catch up on those things. And the rest of us who are married, even though this is sort of a dating message, we will pick up a fair amount of good information along the way that'll be very important for us this morning. All right, let's get our fingers in the text, and let's begin with this. Let's go ahead and start in chapter 2, verse 8. It's found in your outlines. You can follow along there or in your copy of God's Word. It says, "The voice of my beloved, behold, he comes leaping over the mountains, bounding over the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Behold, there he stands behind our wall, gazing through the windows, looking through the lattice." The scene, remember, it's a flashback. This is the mountains of Lebanon where the Shulamite has grown up. It's a mountainous region. And you remember, she's a farm girl, so this is the farmhouse. And she hears him calling her in the distance. She looks out on the hillside, and here he comes running down the mountain. He's like a track star. He's coming down the mountain to see her. In fact, he's a little bit like a gazelle. You can picture him jumping from rock to rock on the way down here. And he is running. He is excited. He is going to get there. He can't wait to see her. In fact, I sort of picture him like one of those Gatorade commercials. You know how the guys are all sweaty? That's probably what he's like when he finally arrives at the door. He's a man in perspiration because he can't wait to get to see this girl that he loves so desperately. And when he gets to the door, he's not just content to knock and wait. He sort of turns into a little bit of a peeping Tom. He's, you know, going around the corners of the windows, popping up with a big smile on his face. "Are you there, honey? I can't wait to see you." He is excited to see this girl. Now, this is not the main point of the text. I know that. But I think it's worth mentioning this because we're happen to be here. Solomon is a very motivated guy. If you look at the rest of the book, you study other things he's written, he is a motivated, focused, go-get-em kind of fella. And ladies, Let's put this down right here. Point one, ladies, you want to be dating, if you're single, date a motivated man. I know that's really true. And I just want to say this, because young ladies, I have been in the ministry for 20 years, and I have seen many young ladies who happen to come into my office, and they've got this guy, and they're dating a guy who is not very motivated. In fact, he's sort of a lazy guy. This is that, well, he's eventually going to get a job guy. Or when he gets a job, it's like, well, doesn't it just provide enough? I don't want to necessarily get a better job. I don't want to necessarily make sure I improve myself so I can provide better for my wife and children. The bare minimum is very comfortable for me. The road of least resistance is the way I want to go. That is called a lazy guy. It is not called a motivated guy. Ladies, you do not want to be dating those kind of guys. Seriously. You think I'm joking? You want to date a guy who wants to do something. He wants to be motivated. He wants to work hard. You want to date a guy who wants to make a difference in his life for Jesus Christ. You don't want to date a guy who just happens to attend a church, but you want to date a guy who actually wants to do something to serve Christ in his church. You want to date a motivated man. Now, interestingly, there are all kinds of men out there, and they have adult toys. They always have time for those things. They always have time for football, which, by the way, nothing wrong with football. Today's a big day for it. I'm not going to argue with that. But you'll notice these are the guys who are always critiquing the guys who are on the field and telling them what they're doing wrong, even though the guys in the field are hot and sweaty and trying as hard as they can. And these are the same guys who can't even get up and get their own bag of potato chips, right? Because they're lazy. Do not date these kind of men. That is a little love for the young ladies out there. I'm just warning you about that. Next, let's put our finger back in the text, and you'll notice that I made a little boo-boo. As I made up the outline, I happened to copy the text from the previous verse. So, I'm just going to flip over to my actual copy of God's Word and read for you what should have been there, which is verses 10 through 13. This is what it says. My beloved speaks and says to me, "Arise, my love, my beautiful one, and come away. For behold, the winter is past. The rain is over and gone. The flowers appear on the earth. The time for singing has come, and the voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land. The fig tree ripens its figs, and the vines are in the blossom. They give forth fragrance. Arise, my love, my beautiful one, and come away." Well, what's going on? You can say he's at the door. He's inviting her out for a date. It is springtime. They have probably been apart all winter long. They haven't seen each other, and their absence has made the heart grow fonder. So he is excited to go out for a walk with her in the country. And he's talking about all the things of spring that are in bloom. The flowers are out. The turtle dove is out, which, by the way, the turtle dove is a migratory bird. It has migrated back to their region. It's a springtime thing. The fig tree is in blossom, and their love is in blossom. Okay, a couple side notes here that aren't directly in the text, but I think it's worth mentioning. Let's talk about the date he decides to take her on. Solomon does not decide to take her to a movie. Note to self. Movie, no conversation and the lights are out, right? That's not a good date. Where does he decide to take her? Into a public place, outside, for a walk. Now think about this. When you're out for a walk with your girlfriend that you're so excited to see because you haven't seen her all winter, is there going to be a lot of pressure for physical intimacy when you're walking around in public? No. Movie? Yes. Okay. Why there's no pressure for physical intimacy, do they have a great amount of personal and deep communication when they're walking around? What do you think? Yes, there's great privacy in their communication because they're walking around in public. So I think this is a note, guys and gals. When you go on a date, you don't want to go on a date that puts lots of pressure for physical intimacy. You want to go on a public place, and you want to walk where you can have great opportunity for private and deep conversation, because that's the kind of stuff you need when you're dating. And by the way, we're going to delve into that issue much more in a few minutes later in the message, the kind of things you need in your dating life. So the number one point here is notice where he takes her for a date. It's a great place for conversation. Next thing we need to notice here. Ladies, I'm trying to read my own writing here. Not only is he not an unmotivated man, he's a motivated man, but I want you to notice he's a positive man. Now, he is seeing everything with all roses right now. He's pretty excited about the girl he's dating. And if you read the rest of the Song of Solomon, you find out he's a very positive guy. Here's the warning to you ladies. In 20 years of ministry, I've seen a number of these ladies who come in my office and they have this guy they're dating, and he is a pathetic, depressing fella. And they, you know why they like him? Because they think they can fix him. The ladies are giving me an amen right now. I can see it. Their heads are going. They think they can fix him, and they think they can help him. Now, ladies, where does this come from? This comes from your mothering instinct. That's what it is. But you do not mother the man you marry. You mother your children, not your man. You are created to be a helpmate for him, not his mother. So, here's the point. Don't marry a man you have to mother. Because if you have to mother him, at first it may be fun, but I got to tell you two things. Number one, it'll become very repulsive to you over time when you have to mother him perpetually. Number two, you will discover that he actually never changes. True? Yes. So don't marry a man that you're attracted to because you have to mother. If that's who you're dating right now, you need to get rid of him. You have a child that can shave. You do not have a man. A man is a leader, and a man needs a wife who is a helpmate for him, not a mother for him. Okay, I've helped out the ladies here with a little practical advice. Guys, I got to help you out with something here too, just to bring some balance into things. Let's go to the next section here. Verse 14, he says, "Oh, my dove, in the clefts of the rock, in the crannies of the cliff, let me see your face. Let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet and your face is lovely." You remember, he's looking through the windows. He's been gazing through the lattice. He just can't wait to see this woman he loves so desperately. But you can see how she's acting. And does she know he's there? Oh, yeah. She knows he's there. But she's doing the dove thing, just sort of like peeking around the corner and then hiding again. I mean, what is happening here? My guess is that, like many women, when their boyfriend comes to ask him for a date, they're not done in the bathroom. Still fixing their hair. Still putting on their makeup. That's my guess. I know it's a little bit of a leap, but that's probably what's going on. She doesn't come to the door and open it for him and invite him in and say, "Hey, you know, I'm not ready yet." He has to wait until she is presentable before she sees him and before he sees her. That is very important. In other words, guys, date a woman who is modest. As you study this woman throughout this book, she is extremely modest with her charms. Does she know that she has looks that can seriously turn guys' heads? Yes, she does. She knows she is stunningly beautiful. But she's very modest with her charms, and she's extremely protective of her purity. Guys, this is the kind of woman you want to date and the kind of woman you want to marry. Because what you find out here is that she She is modest when it comes to her time around men in public, and even with Solomon in public. But when we get to the latter part of the book and she is married, you'll find she is very aggressive and creative when it comes to intimacy. Guys, you do not want to date the girl who wears the smallest swimsuit on the beach. You don't. She is trying to attract attention. The problem is she is trying to attract everyone's attention, not just yours. She is not modest in public. You want to marry a woman who is modest in public, but in marriage she is passionate in private. You don't want to get those two mixed around, or you will have a serious headache on your hands. Okay, now this gets down to the verse that I wanted to sort of launch out on. I didn't want to spend too much time on the earlier ones, but this is the main thing I want to spend time on here. This little one, verse 15. It says, catch the foxes for us, the little foxes that spoil the vineyards, for our vineyards are in blossom. The ESV, as you look at it, has this in the quotes of something that Solomon says. Many scholars, as they look at this, it's really up for debate. Who says this verse? Is it the Shulamite or is it Solomon who says it? The quotes, by the way, are not in Hebrew. Hebrew doesn't have quotes, so that was the editor's guess as to where to put it. I'm actually not siding with the ESV on this one. I'm going to go with the other scholars who say this is actually probably on her lips. And let me tell you why. It has to do with the structure of how this section is put together. If you noticed, we started with a very motivated man who has a very positive outlook on life. And then, all of a sudden, we went to a very modest woman who has a very realistic outlook on life. That's what I think is how this passage is structured. That would leave these words on her lips rather than his, because it's a realistic outlook on life. What is this talking about? It is talking about the little problems in their relationship that, unless they're addressed, will make a big difference. That's your fill in the blank. It's about the little problems in their relationship that, unless they're addressed, will make a big difference. Solomon doesn't see those. He is all flowers. He is all turtle doves. Hey, it's going great. She says, well, I love you. This is great, but there are some issues we're going to have to deal with that are on the table here for this relationship to work strong and work long. Now, one of those issues is the fact she is very concerned she is not going to get a chance to spend much time with him when he is so busy with the affairs of state. We're not going to dive into that this week. We're going to look at that next week, because next week's text deals with this as she has sort of a nightmare about what it might be like. But we're going to actually spend some time just working on this very issue. What are little things that make a big difference that, unless they're dealt with in the dating days, can ruin the married days? She calls them little foxes. Now, let's unpack this. You remember she is a farming girl, a vineyard family. Now, if you work in the vineyards, there are big problems and there are little problems. Big problems are lions and leopards. They come down from the mountainside. You know they're in the mountainside because he's been bouncing down like a gazelle on the rocks. You're out there working, a lion or leopard takes you out, it's over with real quick. The little problems that don't seem to make a difference, but they actually do in the end, are the foxes. The scholars tell us these foxes are just about a foot tall, and they're very difficult to keep out of the vineyards. They'd work their way around the walls, and they would get in, and what they would do is they would burrow in by the roots, loosening the roots' grip on the soil so the vines could not get the necessary nutrients to produce a good harvest of grapes. Not only that, but these little pesky guys, what they would do is if they could get to the grapes, they would just start eating these things like crazy, fresh fruit. Now, if you're the farmer, you're looking out there, you don't see a problem, not necessarily up front, but when you go to get your harvest, what you find is your grape harvest is greatly diminished because your foxes have been eating them up, and what is there is not that good because it wasn't tight to the soil. And in the long run, what happens? You go bankrupt. It destroys you. These little problems ruin your business. Now, what I did was I started to write down what are little things, not necessarily in this text, but little things in marriages or that need to be addressed when people are dating, because if they don't get addressed, they will blossom into a full-blown marital disaster. I wrote down four things. They're just out of my head from experience. We're going to go over the first one for a while, then quickly the last three. Pretty important stuff. Here they are. Roles is number one. What are roles in a marriage? This is crucial. You must understand this. You have to understand what the biblical role of a husband and a wife is, and you will not get this from culture. You will not get this from most churches, and if you get this wrong, it will destroy your marriage. Let me explain this to you. There are two major viewpoints out there that are held in our world today. One is called egalitarianism. The other is called complementarianism. This is what egalitarianism teaches. It teaches that men and women, as a husband and wife in a marriage, are 100% really equal in all things except for their plumbing. That's what it teaches. And when you have a difficulty between you and your wife, what do you do? There's no way to decide it besides play rock, paper, scissors, and who wins gets their way. That's really what egalitarianism honestly teaches. It is what our culture teaches. It is what many churches teach. Even churches that claim to preach and teach the Bible will teach egalitarianism. That a husband and wife in their roles are equal, and there's no deference in them. Now, I'm going to tell you something very clearly, and I'm serious about this. I've read the egalitarian arguments, and I've read this other thing called the Bible, and they don't match up. Egalitarianism is clearly unbiblical. It is cultural. In its roots, it is cultural in its drive, and many, many Bible-teaching churches capitulate to egalitarianism because of the cultural pressure rather than keeping their finger in this text. Very important, and if you do not understand this, I guarantee you it'll cause you huge amounts of marital pain if you just take this right out of culture rather than go back to the Bible. The other viewpoint that is biblical is called complementarianism. And I wrote that down in full in your notes for you. And this is essentially what it says. A man and a woman and a husband and a wife are equal in personhood, equal in value before God, but they are given distinct and different roles to play in marriage, and they complement one another. They're not equal in roles. They're complementary roles. Now, most people do not understand this, and some of you are going, where did you find that? In the Bible. Let's go ahead and put our finger in the text in some of the more sticky-wicky passages, and I'm going to get all the feminists really upset right now. So feminists, you can go ahead and get prepared to be upset. Just remember, you're not upset with me, you're upset with God. It's His word. What does it say? Ephesians chapter 5. Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is head of the wife, even as Christ is head of the church, his body, as is himself its Savior. Now, as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit to in everything to their husbands. All right. Point one, a wife's role is to submit to her husband's leadership. And I know a number of you are going, that's what the scriptures say. It's right there. Okay, let's think about this. How was a wife created? A wife was created back in Genesis. She was created for Adam and from Adam, right? It was not good for Adam to be alone, so I will make a helpmate suitable for him. A wife is to be her husband's helpmate. And she was also created from Adam. A rib was taken out of him, making him incomplete, formed into Eve, and when Eve comes back to Adam, he becomes complete again. So she was created for Adam and from Adam. Guys, you need to understand, this is saying, by the way, that if your wife submits to you, guess who is the leader in the home? You are. Guess who is responsible for the spiritual temperature in the home? You are, guys. Guess who is responsible before God for what happens there and to lead lovingly and sacrificially? You are, guys, and your wife is your helpmate in that. Now, ladies, let me just address this in another angle. Culturally, the pressure is upon you to say exactly the opposite of this. You're out having coffee with the other ladies, and they're all sitting there chewing gum, doing their nails. You know how that goes? And they say, well, what do you do for a living? And the one lady says, you know, I'm a thermonuclear physicist, and, you know, oh, I'm this, and I'm that. And then you're thinking, well, I do this really swift job. Maybe I should tell them that, oh, what do I do? My big job is, I work as whatever. I don't know. I can't think of anything right now. My mind just went blank. That's not your primary job. Your primary job is as a helpmate to your husband. Your secondary job is what you do vocationally. Your primary job is to be a helpmate. And now, wouldn't that freak all the other ladies out if you said that at the coffee shop? Like, oh, you're just a wife? I'm like, but that's what God created me for, to be a helpmate for him. That's where I find my joy. That's what I'm supposed to do. In fact, that's what you're supposed to do too. All right. Next thing. These roles are not arbitrary. In other words, God did not sit there and go, husband and wife, who should I put in charge? Let's roll dice. That's not the way it would put together. There's a parallelism between a husband's leadership over his family and his wife and Christ's leadership over the church. Remember, a marriage is to be an earthly parallel to Christ's relationship to the church. Very important. So these are not arbitrary roles whatsoever. Next thing to say is these roles are also not reversible. And some of you think, well, maybe for the first 10 years we'll let him be in charge, and the next 10 years we'll let her be in charge. It doesn't work that way. Marriage is derivative of the relationship between Christ and the church. They're not reversible roles. And some of you are saying, but my wife is so smart. She's so much better at so many things than me. I married up. And I'm like, oh, God bless you. God gave you a wonderful counselor. But you're still in charge. Isn't that the way it is? Guys, you're still in charge, but you married up and have a great counselor. Okay, feminists, now you're all mad at God. Not mad at me. Remember that. Chauvinists, let's go after you guys. Let's keep our finger right back in the text. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. And what does that mean? And gave himself up for her. A husband's role is to lovingly sacrifice for his wife. If you start to unpack this by looking at Christ and the church, all of a sudden it becomes meaningful. Well, is Christ the head of the church? Well, yeah. That's not going to be reversible. But what did Christ do for the church? He humbled himself to the point of death. Death on the cross in our place for our sins. But he didn't just die for us, but he sanctifies us, doesn't he? He releases us from sin. He makes us into a new creation. He will eventually glorify us. To be like the prime example of what it looks like for God to be gracious, the most graciousness that will ever be displayed will be us in eternity through Christ. Talk about sacrifice. Talk about love. That is what Christ did for the church. Husbands, that is what you do for your wives. Think of it like your wife is a beautiful flower and you sacrifice and you work hard to cultivate the soil, to nurture that flower so it can bloom fully and most beautifully. Husbands, that is what you do for your wives. Sacrifice yourself as Christ did for the church. Now, there's a very interesting verse in Genesis that explains how this often goes wrong. It's Genesis 3:16. Let me read it for you and then unpack it. It's right after sin enters the world. What happens? God tells about the curse, and the curse is this: your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. This is talking about how sin will manifest itself in a husband and wife relationship. The word desire here doesn't mean normal marital attraction. By the way, Eve was attracted to Adam much earlier in the text before sin entered into the world. So what does it mean when it says your desire will be for your husband? Literally in the Hebrew, it says your desire will be for your husband's position. In other words, instead of desiring to be a helpmate suitable for him, sin in a woman's life as a wife, she doesn't want to be the role of a helpmate. She'll want to be the role of a challenger to his position of leadership, not a support for his position of leadership. That is how sin influences the marriage relationship. And then it goes on to guys, and he will rule over you. This word for rule is not the king that sits in the lazy boy with bonbons in his hand and a real easygoing king kind of deal. This is hammer rule. This is tight-fisted authoritarian rule. This is the husband will be head of the house, but he will do it by yelling, by screaming, by leaving his wife shaking like a frightened dog in the corner as he yells at the top of his lungs and throws things. That is disgusting. But that is how sin taints the role that a husband and wife play. She will try and challenge his leadership, and he will try and beat her back into submission rather than sacrifice for her. Folks, that is an egalitarian marriage. Do you see why it's filled with controversy and pain? Well, we're equal. I'm not going to submit and support your leadership. I'm going to challenge it. We're equal. Well, he says, well, no, I'm in charge. And if you won't go back into your corner on your own, I'll force you there. But the biblical is complementarian, where she's the helpmate suitable for him. And he's the one who leads, but he does it by sacrificing himself for her. Very important. A little thing that makes a big difference. You're young, you're dating, you need to have the conversation of what biblical roles are before marriage. If you don't get this one ironed out, can you see how this will turn into a huge issue once you are married? Anybody agree? Huge. Okay, I'll be quicker about the other three, I promise. Here they are. Another conversation you have to have is goals. In other words, where are you going in life? What do you want to get out of life? It's really helpful when you're dating to try and write your tombstones together. Honestly, what do you want said about you when it's all over with? You have to have those kind of conversations. You know, what are your spiritual goals? What are your life goals? If you don't have these things, man, it's going to hurt. Number three, priorities. What is important to you? What moves you? Where are you going? Number four, anchors. What are fixed things about your relationship that will not change? Let me explain what I mean by anchors. When Cindy and I were dating, we had this conversation, and we agreed that an anchor in our relationship would be that we would not ride alone with someone of the opposite sex in the car going someplace. We just always wanted to be above board that way, so we anchored that, period. Another anchor, we wanted to make sure we tried to have dinner together as a family. Now, I'm just going to tell you that it is very difficult right now. I have one boy in senior high wrestling, one boy in junior high wrestling, and then, of course, there's this little girl who's involved in dance. So it's difficult right now, but we have to keep coming back to that anchor. We've agreed upon this. This is, we're going to keep trying to tie ourselves back up to it when the rope comes loose. Wrap it around again. Another anchor we've tried to agree on that has been really difficult we've found to do, and I'm just this confession of the pastor to the congregation, we wanted to do family devotional time. And right now, it's all we can do to actually have family dinner time. Getting somebody together for another time is just really difficult. We're struggling with it. And so I was praying about it this week and saying, Lord, this is one of the anchors that we have in our family, and I'm having a hard time having my anchor hold. What should we do? And this is what God said to me, and I'm just going to tell you, and I'm going to try and do it, and you guys can hold me accountable. Is that fair? God was saying to me, you know, let your wife prepare the physical food for dinner. You prepare the spiritual food for dinner. And we serve them at the same time. In other words, what we've been trying to do this past week, she puts the dishes out. I come in and of the chapter I read that day, and I have maybe two verses highlighted, and I say during the dinner time, guys, let me just share for you as your dad just this verse and what it meant to me, and here's another verse and what it meant to me, and we just discuss it for a few minutes over dinner. It's not a big time, but it's an attempt to reattach ourselves to an anchor we agreed upon years ago in our relationship. All right, give you a conclusion here. I was thinking about this, the importance of having these good conversations when you're dating, deep conversations, because that's what Solomon is doing when he's taking her for these walks in the country. And what came to mind was the story of a couple, a Christian couple, a famous Christian couple, who completely neglected these dating conversations. And they paid for it bitterly. Let me tell you their story. Many of you know the story of John and Molly Wesley. John Wesley, he's the founder of Methodism. Their relationship began when he was 48 years old. He was never married. He was walking across a bridge in London and slipped on the ice and broke his ankle. He was taken into the house of a lady named Molly Vizelle. She was a widow. She was 41 years old, had four kids. And John kept a very detailed journal in his life. And so all the things that were happening were in there. Except the journal says that, you know, he came into her house, and then 8 days later, she appears in the journal and says, "We got married today." After only 8 days of knowing each other. What happened next is what most of their biographers call the 30-year war. She at first attempted to try to travel with John Wesley. That didn't work. He had an insane pace to life. He traveled 250,000 miles on horseback in his life and delivered 40,000 sermons. She found herself completely stressed out, seasick, and frustrated emotionally because of the mobs that oftentimes would attack him. So after 4 years of marriage, she decided she would just stay home and try to raise the kids and let him do the traveling. But he just stayed away. In fact, he even said to her that he expected in no way to slow down his pace because he was married. She became deathly ill at one point. And message was sent to him to come because she may not live. He arrived at 1 o'clock in the morning, and she had a fever they thought she wouldn't survive from. The fever broke within the hour. He was gone before 2 in the morning. Stayed home less than an hour to see her. It got very difficult from that point on. She began to hate his ministry, hate his life. Rather than being a helpmate, she actually sent letters to the paper to trying to undermine his ministry. She publicly accused him of adultery with their housekeeper. Those who had stayed in their house discovered that she had black and blue marks on her because of the beatings that they ended up in their physical fights. One minister writes down in his memoirs about a time he saw her dragging him across the room by his hair, pulling out tufts of it as they screamed and yelled at each other. He kept up an extensive letter-writing campaign to other single women, which drove his wife to insane levels of jealousy. The latter part of their years were spent apart. She died, she was buried, and it was only after she was in the ground that somebody even bothered to tell her that she was gone. It seems to me that they should have read the Song of Solomon. They should have taken a lesson while they were dating to go for long walks in the country and have important conversations of those little foxes that don't seem that important when you're so deeply in love, but actually in the long run make all the difference. Conversations about roles, goals, priorities, and what would be their anchors.